Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. On today's show, our guest is Bob Grove with the Climate Council of Greater Kansas City, who speaks with Eco Radio KC's Craig LeBeau about our city's important climate issues and how they will be addressed. But first, the environmental news for the week of 225 on Eco Radio KC. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Democracy Now! Reports, Trump is considering naming Princeton University Professor Emeritus and White House Science Advisor William Happer to head the new committee to examine whether climate change poses a threat to national security. Happer is a known climate change denier. He has falsely accused NOAA of manipulating climate data, and he has compared climate science to the Holocaust. USA Today reports the United States Supreme Court agreed to decide whether contamination of groundwater that seeps into rivers, lakes, and oceans violates the Clean Water Act. Dumping pollutants directly into navigable waters is prohibited by the 47-year-old law, but it is less clear about indirect sources. The High Court will hear the appeal of the county in County of Maui versus Hawaii Wildlife Fund this fall. Lawrence Journal World reports, owners of hybrid or electric vehicles will pay increased state registration fees if proposed bill, Kansas House Bill 2372, is signed into law. The state uses fuel taxes to fund highway construction and maintenance, and the alternative fuel vehicles are using less gasoline. There is already such law in other states, including both Nebraska and Missouri. Now, Mike Murphy has an update on PFAS.
For the third week in a row, Eco Radio KC has some updates on the PFAS issue. You might remember 2 weeks ago, Teresa Wilkie and Elaine Giesel spoke about PFAS with regard to the water of the United States. Last week, both Elaine and Teresa attended a public announcement by the Environmental Protection Agency Region 7 at the Community Center in Leavenworth, and we brought you some of that. This week, we're bringing you activist Pat Elder. Pat is primarily known for his work with counter-recruitment in high schools, but more recently, he has turned his focus to PFAS contamination on military bases. Pat spoke at All Souls UU Church on Thursday, February 21st. Here's some of what he had to say.
Tara Kopp is a reporter from Military Times. She wrote an article that blew me away. Okay? I mean, changed my life. It was published about a year ago. And Military Times, go figure. Military Times is actually owned by Gannett, and Gannett owns USA Today. And Gannett is doing a great job with the contamination issue. And not just Military Times, but Marine Corps Times and Army Times. And these guys, they really do excellent work. So remember that. And you know? So I'm reading this article by Tara Kopp, and it's called Why Women Were Told Not to Get Pregnant at George Air Force Base. And so three women, I think, got together. They served at George a long time ago, you know. And you know, one of them said, I had a miscarriage. The other one said, I had a miscarriage. The other one said, I had a hysterectomy at 24. And they were like, okay, this ain't good. And then they put up a Facebook page and 300 women came forward and said, I had a hysterectomy, I had this, I had that. Well, they all drank the water. And the water was all contaminated with these perfluoral alcohol and polyfluoral alcohol substances, perfluorooctanoic acid and perfluorooctanate sulfonic acid. Damn. Yeah, it's George Air Force Base in Victoryville, California. The thing is, the levels of contamination haven't dissipated because these chemicals don't break down ever. And so they tested the water in Victoryville in wells outside of the base and found that they were still extraordinarily polluted. Okay? The stuff hits women worse than men. Okay? And it causes fetal development problems. And they're trying to trace it. We don't know. It's not firm yet. Autism. Maybe one of the leading causes. Because it passes through breast milk. And so we have studies that will indicate PFAS contamination through breast milk and IQ problems. This is something that is, it's historic. It's deeply upsetting. And I'm not overstating it. So let me just take you through this as quickly as I can. You see this, you know, they're killing us. So there was a report that the Pentagon did, and it says March of 2018, but we didn't find out about it until almost the end of June 2018. And they were really compelled to do so because there were press reports here and there. But this is kind of like the United States of amnesia. You know how you get to the point where you watch the TV and you go, Jesus, how could that be? Oh, my God. And then it just keeps happening. Well, this is one of those things, right? And so they published this report. And there's, I think it was 141 military bases with various levels of these poisons in the water. Most of them worse than George Air Force Base. And you can just Google it, and you Google DOD PFAS, and you'll get the report, and it'll show you all across the country. So this PFOS and PFOA, they're in the foam that the firefighters use. Okay, so it was 1939, and a scientist working, I think it was in Bloomington, Minnesota, stumbled on the ingredients that became Teflon. And they merged 8 carbon atoms with 6, 8, 10, 12, 40 fluoride atoms to create a whole host of these chemicals. The guy mixed the two by mistake, went to bed, came back to his clinic the next morning, and saw that he had a substance that was stronger than anything ever developed. And could repel fire and grease and water, and it's in its liquid form put out fires better than anything ever developed by mankind. Okay, so we're dealing with something that is, man, I've been searching for the word. I don't know the word. Maybe somebody here could, like, I've been thinking about, you know, biblical stuff, or like Prometheus. Remember the story of the Greek Prometheus, and he stole the fire from the gods, and he brought the, you know, it's at that level of thought. Like, you know, maybe the gods are getting their laugh now on this, because now we're putting out fires with things that are causing chromosomal deletions 6 and 8 generations down the line. Hello? So here you go. And they light these fires, and they put them out. And they light them, and they put them out. And they do it regularly at thousands of military bases across the world. What the hell? Who's in charge? Thousands of wells. The health effects affect women more severely. They cause liver damage, high cholesterol, decreased response to vaccines, increase in thyroid disease, asthma diagnosis. Meanwhile, Harvard University scientists say 1 part per trillion affects health. 1. We have a Navy, a closed Air Force base in Louisiana. Base was closed 30 years ago. England Air Force Base. It has 10,900,000 parts per trillion in the groundwater. And you know, there are plumes of groundwater that seep miles away, and there are people that you can see on Google Earth, you know, that little yellow man that walks around, and you can see the wells, and there's nothing in the press. These people are drinking contaminated water. Right. Oh, man. So I had an idea. And so my daughter she quit her job at the law firm, and she's going to go travel in South America for the next year. Right on, man. That's so cool. So I'm going to fly out to L.A. We're going to get in her, CRV, and we are going to drive to the 8 worst bases in the country, according to the military. And we're going to put a sign up. I have a little podium and a little sign, and I work now with civilian exposure, so just a little sign, a little podium, and she's going to film me with the camera, and we're going to beam it, you know, on Facebook, and, you know, we've got WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and Civilian Exposure, World Beyond War, and a few other groups, and, you know, we're going to see if we might get one, mainstream press. But I sent a press release to 150 outlets, the New York Times and Huffington Post and Washington Post and Baltimore. Hey, man, we're doing this. And doesn't work that way. Just doesn't work that way. I don't give a damn, you know. So anyway, China Lake, 8 million. Cannon, 2.6 million. Dallas former NAS, 1.2 million. England Air Force Base, 10.9 million. Patrick Air Force Base down in Florida, Cocoa Beach. Oh, my God. Cocoa Beach is so terribly contaminated. They're at 4.3 million. Jacksonville, Myrtle Beach, and Langley. And then I'm back home. Yeah, man.
And are those the tests, like, through the tap water? Or when you're testing the well?
These are well tests. These are not drinking water tests. These are where they go down to where the wells are. But two points need to be made here. One is that the majority of municipal water systems pull from groundwater. And two, when this stuff comes out of bases, and you know, we have bases that were closed 30 years ago, and it's still seeping out of these bases, and it'll wind up in sewers. And so what happens with the sewers, it never breaks down. So 30 years later, a municipality will, they always slather the sludge on farm fields. That's just what they do with the seagulls come by but we have municipalities across the country now and in Germany, and that's an important thing. Hopefully I'll get a chance to talk about that. It's poisonous. It's killing the birds. It's killing the plants. It runs off. It's killing the fish. I mean, it really is. Like Wurtsmith Air Force Base in Michigan. It was closed 30 years ago. Deer are dying today. The state of Michigan said you can't eat the deer. You can't eat the fish from 30 years ago. It's bad, man. So I hear your question. It's really valid, you know, like tap water. It's like when we were in Belton today, you know. We were riding around in Belton because, Richards Gabar, they were at 373,000 parts per trillion, which is bad. I mean, it's bad. And so everybody around there, if you have well water, you're gonna get really sick. But you notice in Belton, they've got that big water tank. Well, what's in there? So we pulled up the information from the Environmental Working Group. That's one hell of a website, by the way, EWG, Environmental Working Group, because they've got all kinds of data. And we found that there were five cancer-causing chemicals in Belton's water above guidelines that cause cancer. Not mine, because mine, the PFAS one, isn't regulated. It's not regulated by the EPA. They don't regulate it. It's the worst of all of them, but they don't regulate it because the United States military has liability that may touch the trillions of dollars. So they're going to allow people to be poisoned. It's that bad. It's time for a revolution. What did they put in there about, abolish it? Remember the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence? Declaration of Independence? Remember what Thomas Jefferson wrote? Who can tell me? If you think things aren't working for you, it's your duty to abolish it. Well, I don't think things are working real well if these guys are poisoning us and they know it. Jesus. Yeah.
No, it's not working well because people have been told out there at the plant that you went to today. Well, Bill Clinton, for whatever he's worth, he did a good job writing the EEOICPA. He told the people in the nuclear weapons industry, we work these people under these conditions without their knowledge. that they would be in this type of environment. And we did not let them know. They gave us physicals every day. I mean, every 1, 2, and 5 years. One year, second year, and then the fifth year, all the way up until you're 50 years old. I don't think people get what was going on. Around here, well, we know that it's so political. And we are in the Midwest, that military, that proud thing, you know. We got to talk.
No, it's all good. So, here's my trip coming up. If you go to civilianexposure.org, that's our website. Civilian Exposure was started by several hundred spouses of their dead husbands who were stationed at Camp Lejeune. I don't know if you guys have been reading about Camp Lejeune, but a lot of men drank bad water and a lot of men died of, thyroid cancer is bad stuff, apparently. So a lot of liver and thyroid cancers from various chemicals. We don't have a listing of PFAS contamination at Camp Lejeune, but we have a hunch it's pretty bad there too because they had several burn pits there, you know. So, I mean, I've been an anti-war guy all along, you know, and I kind of had an epiphany. I like that word, epiphany. So civilian exposure, that's me now, not World Beyond War, because, you know, it's fine. I'm against the empire, you know, but I'm more for, you know, like protecting human health. And I think I can do that more effectively without, you know, talking about imperialism. Like, you know, so I'm just kind of switching. Do we have a question?
I just wanted you to say the name of that group again. Civilian
Exposure. .org, civilianexposure.org. So anyway, these are the places we're going to be going. So if you go there, you can try to track our movement. There's also a Facebook page. You can also go to WILPF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and they'll be tracking it as well. But, you know, we have to make our own media, guys. We got to make our own media. They're not helping. So anyway... Don't get pregnant at George. Kate Kelly, she was 19. It was 1975, that long ago. But the stuff is still as bad today. And she's sitting next to her bunkmate, and the bunkmate says, don't get pregnant. That's what they told me. Well, there's Kate. And this is all from Tara Kopp with Military Times. And Kate drank the water. So she found out that all of these, infections were common. And she said, you don't ask questions. You figure the military is going to take care of you. And she said, when you're stateside, you certainly don't expect toxic exposure. So when I give this overseas, man, they don't, not good. So Kate drank the water. And she puts two and two together. And she had three miscarriages and a hysterectomy. All right, and then she went to get her medical records, and they were redacted. So and this happened to 300 women, because Tara Kopp is not just a reporter; she's an activist too. And she said, "Well, go try to get your medical records." So every time on the medical records, when they get to the reason, they black it out. We're living in a fascist state. Lisa McRae's baby was born, stillborn at 9 months. She went and got her, she almost bled to death. 300 women. But the military wasn't counting on Facebook. So there's an example of us organizing ourselves, maybe by happenstance, but damn if it didn't happen. And Denise Torrey. They purged everything. These are beautiful women, man, you know, that went on to live their lives and never put two and two together. Lori Clark, infertility issues. She had two normal kids. but now her grandchildren are having problems. Here you go, man. Yeah, yeah. So these two, Tracy and her brother, they grew up in Oscoda, Michigan, near Wurtsmith. That's the one I mentioned with the deer. Did I mention the deer? The brother died at 28. A couple other guys lived on the street, died at 28. If you look at the Google Earth, the fence was behind their house, and Wurtsmith was right there. So all the stuff just drizzled in, and, they were drinking municipal water. So it was one of those water tanks that just pulled the water up from the ground. Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It looked like a jigsaw puzzle picture. So Jean Shaheen, she got some federal money, and she was going to put it to rest. And she had the blood checked of 1,500 people, and all of them had poisoned blood. And they all were working in schools and businesses and lived close to Peace Air Force Base, which had been closed years before. So she basically, you would have thought that this would have really moved the needle. It didn't even get any press. So she introduced a bill in Congress called the PFAS Registry Act, and she only got 6 members of the U.S. Senate to sign on. Because, if you do, you're going against the military. And that's just not, you don't do it. And so... That's where we are. It's Senate Bill 2719. I couldn't get Cardin to sign on, and I couldn't get Van Hollen to sign on. And these guys are supposed to be liberal Democrats. Well, not really. Now, I apologize for my harsh language here. Not really. Okay. So Michael Dorson is a chemical industry insider, okay? And he had written position papers for, DuPont, basically saying, look, I'll be your guy. These are multi-million dollar attorneys, it's fine. That beryllium stuff that, you're not going to hurt you, right? Mercury, schmercury, right? Well, the same thing with PFOS. So just to give you an idea of the magnitude of this problem, they bring this guy in to run the EPA's enforcement of PFAS. The Senate saw it to their credit because they confirmed, nominations, and they rejected his nomination. But Trump ordered him to take his position against the United States Senate. But he basically came under a lot of fire, and he left his job at the EPA. But since then, Pruitt has been replaced by Wheeler, who's just as bad. Wheeler comes from defending the coal industry. And Wheeler is in no way going to, order the EPA to enforce PFAS regulations. So it's not regulated still. I don't know. Did anybody here see that news last week about the EPA not regulating PFAS? So important. So important. Anybody got a brick wall I can bang my head up against? Okay, here's the new guy. The new fox in the hen house. Chemical industry champion Pruitt forced out. He was replaced by Wheeler. has Wheeler been confirmed? Yes. So now he is. This is a little old. Early in his career, he worked for the EPA, and then he worked for Inhofe. You all know Inhofe's record on climate. It's ridiculous. It's liberals. That's what it is. Chemical, schmemical. They're not going to hurt you. So that's Inhofe. You should look at his campaign finance reports through, opensecrets.org. These people are paid for by the chemical industry. And so anyway, Wheeler is not going to regulate the stuff. So why? Well, because the Pentagon faces potential for $1 trillion in liability worldwide, And if you subject the PFAS to a maximum contaminant level, MCLs are maximum contaminant levels. So on the really bad stuff, they have MCLs. And that means that if a municipality exceeds that, they can be sued if they don't clean it up. It also means that if a polluter knowingly discharges it, they can be sued and be ordered to clean it up. So we're talking about an issue of liability and litigation here in the trillions. And so that's why we don't have any action. Because the people that put the guys in Congress are the military and the corporations that have put the chemicals in the ground in the first place. That's why it's not changing. And that's why it gets back to the Declaration of Independence when Jefferson wrote that, it's your duty to abolish systems that don't work for you. And that's the entire United States government. I'm not a radical. The report that you saw earlier from the DOD in March mentioned, 141 bases, but it also mentioned 9 from overseas. And just to give you an idea, you guys, Richards Gabar had 373,000 parts per trillion. Where's the Belgium one? Right here. U.S. Army, USAG, United States Air Guard? Nah, hell. Benelux. Caserne d'Amarais. It had water. This is actually tap water at 84 to 94 parts per trillion. And the entire village was given, bottled water indefinitely. And everybody on base given bottled water indefinitely. Yeah, I mean, like they moved really quickly on it, but these are really low numbers. Okay, I mean, we have numbers that we know of in Germany now because we have people that like speak German and are able to send stuff to me translated that are more like what we have here in Missouri in the 200,000 to 300,000 range. Okay, but now I'm on Germany real quickly. This is an interesting story. The little town of Wittlichland, Wittlichland, is right outside of Spangledem Air Base, which is a joint U.S.-NATO air base. And, they routinely light these fires, and they routinely put them out with the stuff. But the stuff mostly goes into the sewer drains. And so it's the municipality of Wittlichland. And they slather the stuff on the fields. I mentioned that earlier. So Wittlichland tried to sue the United States government. They were told they couldn't, right? Did I mention that earlier?
No.
Yeah. And so they sued the German government. They're trying to sue the German government. So I think that litigation is going to be very important. But, I'm the only person to have written on it, and I'm in the minor leagues, man. Like, my stuff gets read by maybe 10,000 people across the country. I'm not major league guy by any stretch. But I'm telling you that Wittlichland, something that if you Google, you won't find it except for my stuff. And I got it from a German press release because a friend in Germany had heard me about a year ago, sent it to me and translated it. And I had it translated a second time by another person. And because of the status of forces agreement between the United States government and the government of Germany, which was put together initially in 1945, they're not allowed to sue us. Come on. They're vassals. We are the Lord. They don't like that, boy. Oh, the Germans are proud people. When you go to Germany and you talk about us being the lords and them being the vassals, they don't like it. But that's the reality, and they know it, and there's nothing they can do about it. So the water's unsafe to drink in Belgium. Saw that. The U.S. military is poisoning Germany, and I just talked about that. That's right. I forgot I put this in here. Whitlich Land is not permitted to sue the American base. So keep an eye on that if you can. If you Google it, if you put my name in there, at least you'll be able to pull up my thing. So, but the U.S. is also poisoning Japan. And there are a couple Japanese over there. Have you heard about the movement of the base in Okinawa? Has anyone heard about Kadena Air Base being moved? No, they're really environmentally sensitive. So the U.S. has polluted a base so badly. Okay, it's so bad that it's leaving it. And it is walking away from it to go to another area, I guess, to completely destroy that. And they're giving it to the Japanese government. Well, the PFAS contamination in Okinawa is so bad. And it's not regulated. And there's racism involved because Okinawans are not Japanese. 2/3 of the American bases in Japan are on this tiny island of Okinawa who are racially different and speak a different language. And so these guys in Okinawa are doubly screwed by us and the Japanese government. So Okinawa is a really bad, bad case of PFAS contamination. Here was one where you had a drunk U.S. Marine turned on the fire foam. There was no limit to the stuff, and it filled up the 2-acre hangar, 9 feet of foam, 10 feet of foam, and then spilled out into the parking lot, several acres of highly cancerous stuff, which then they just squirted off into the sea. A drunk Marine. So in Ohio, you have, Dayton, Ohio's water is above what the EPA suggests. You don't want to go over at 70 points per trillion, okay? The state of Vermont says 20 points per trillion. Harvard University says 1 point per trillion. So Dayton, Ohio goes above 70 points per trillion. And the manager of the Dayton, Ohio's director of water sent out a warning. Unfortunately, the Air Force has not acted, and that is why I'm writing. Like they're begging the Air Force to clean it up and to set up alternative drinking systems. Ain't happening. So here's a deer in Michigan. The base at Wurtsmouth closed in 93. But you're not allowed to eat the deer meat or eat the fish today. Contaminated water leaches into the soil at Peterson Air Base in Colorado. It had 87,500 parts per trillion. For 25 years, Dan Cruz delivered mail at Peterson and drank the water. Then came the cancer, the thyroid, prostate, testicular, never seen before in his family. And so here they are, they just light stuff on fire. The Air Force, you got 3 Colorado communities that sued the Air Force. And the Air Force said, we don't have to pay you anything. We're above it. And the same thing just happened in the state of Michigan, okay? The state of Michigan, now you can Google this because USA Today did cover it. But this is worth Googling because this gets to the heart of the matter. And so the water is so polluted in areas of Michigan. Several of the lakes have foam around around the shores with fish kills in the thousands, dead deer, dead fish, and it's really high levels of PFAS. And so the state of Michigan, said to the United States Air Force, we demand that you clean it up and you set up alternative drinking systems. And the state and the Air Force responded in public by saying it's not our responsibility, that we are sovereign, that we have sovereignty over you. We are part of the federal government, and we are not going to clean it up, and we're not going to spend a penny to take care of human health. That's USA Today. I mean, that's, or, the Michigan Today is what it is. So, I don't know. So there is some resistance, where people are getting their children tested for their blood in different areas around the country and, just seeing the elevated contamination levels. So, I don't know. Wasn't that cheery? Got to keep your humor, man, So anybody want this? All right, let's go home. Oh, sure.
Do you only investigate military bases, or do you investigate places like Hanford, Washington, and other nuclear waste dump sites?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say I investigate anything. I'm just a big fat troublemaker, and I read what's already been written and investigated and just report it, because I think it might help human health and I can reach a different audience. But no, I am not exclusively just bashing the United States military. You know, a lot of our civilian airports are also using the stuff, and we also have problems there. The FAA had a rule until last year that mandated the use of these poly and per fluoroalkyl chemicals, and that rule was changed last year, and it basically said that you're free to use other substitutes that aren't cancer-causing. So we have a change in that regard, but it's worth finding out, you know, what the deal is here, let's say, at Kansas City Airport. Like, what are they using, and where does it go? And, you know, what are the testing levels in the water here? But what I worry about the most is something like Louisiana, you know, where they put these bases in predominantly African-American communities that really don't have a recourse to any of this. And, you know, you got levels of 10 million, man, in the water. And you have these vulnerable people that are drinking the water directly. And it's just criminal behavior. And those that's our constituents here. Because we love people, and we honor people, respect people, and we have to take care of people, especially those that aren't able to take care of themselves. And that's it. So, you know, I'm kind of switched from that anti-war, you know, stuff. Not that I'm any more fond of war, but I think this is a ticket. Dude.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, Pat. Appreciate it. On behalf of Peaceworks and Kansas City and all the work you do everywhere, you know, it's not just for us on U.S. soil, but this is happening all over the world, so thanks for this information. I'm curious, back to your first topic that you touched on, in terms of counter-recruitment strategies and things, what are some, and if you have any ideas of, so when I have that talk with people about getting recruiters out of high schools, there's, you always get the thing of, well, for some of these kids, it's all they'd have, and I know so many stories of people who, their life was totally turned around by the military and things like that. And so I'm curious, what are the things that you offer and that you encourage to be put into schools as alternatives? Our community has specifically gone into conversations about getting union recruiters to go in for trade schools and getting them. And one of our community members even talked to a representative from a union, and they're like, that sounds like a great idea. Because right now we have an incredible amount of trades jobs open in our country, and those are always really good jobs with lots of good benefits. So I'm curious, what are the things that you have together? And I'm sure you're pulling up resources, so I'm excited to see what those are. And how do you approach that conversation, too, when someone is saying, yeah, but look at all these great things that it did for this person? We know a lot of our anti-war statistics and things, but I'm just curious how you approach that.
Well, we're really vulnerable, you know, and that's our weakest suit, really. You know, what do you tell a kid? You know, I mean, just so many times I wrote an article once, and it was called, 100 Mothers or something like that, and I mean, I talked to 1,000 mothers over 20 years, you know, where they'll come to me and they'll say, my kid wants to join, what do I do? And I'll just say, you know, there's probably not much you can do. You know, if your kid's 18 and joins, then you know, you're powerless. And but if the kid's got it in his head at 17, 18 years old that they want to join, they're going to join. And you know, if it's the recruiter that's playing one-on-one basketball with them, you know, there's not much you can do. But in terms of alternatives, you know, we're I did help produce, and you can go to NOMI, which is the National Network Opposing the Militarization of Youth. I helped start that back in 2001, too. Actually, Rick Johncow put it together. He's in San Diego. He's a brilliant man, but NNOMY.org, and then click on alternatives. And we created a database by state. And, you know, there are all kinds of things by each individual state has. You know, And there's lots of opportunities, you know, to click into, like Job Corps and, you know, just different Department of, you know, Work Services, you know, different federal services for kids to plug into. But, you know, I kind of have not been working that angle at all. I've just been working, there's two ways to do this, you know, from the bottom up and from the top down. And, you know, people always think that I'm going to talk about, you know, what to say to kids. And, you know, I haven't really gone into schools in 15 years now. I've just been dealing instead with administrative deals. But we do have 2,000 schools now, 2,100 schools that have said that, you know, you got to have parental permission to take the military's test. So we weren't able to do it by state, but we were able to do it by more progressive school systems. So I think that sort of answers your question. More of a top-down deal rather than a bottom-up thing.
I think we have to remember that we are killing our own souls, and we're willing to annihilate other persons. So where is that sanctity? Where is that honor and respect? And we just know how troubled the veterans are. If there's 20, 21 per day that are committing suicide, and veterans, you know, that live under bridges, live outdoors, and are they're just troubled by this. I mean, it goes to the very soul, the very core of, you know, what we're supposed to be about, the healing, the brother and sisterhood that we should be caring about. And we should say, when you look back on life, do you want to recognize yourself as a trained killer? Or do you want to be a healer? Do you want to stand up for the person that has no power? Will you accompany this person out of darkness, whether it's alcoholism or, you know, being lost and not having futures? So I think, you know, it is so basic, that, and we don't get that.
Yeah. Thanks, Henry. I appreciate that. Hey, I want to just show you a couple websites pretty quickly. The first one is, this is ours. I have a board of a dozen people. This thing's been going on for 11 years now. It's the National Coalition to Protect Student Privacy. And so, you know, it's a great little website, you know. I mean, Maryland bill, of course, that needs to be changed because it got shut down, you know, last week. You know, stuff about Maine, you know, different testimony, you know, when our bill went on. And New York State. It looks like we're almost, there are 9 members of the Board of Regents in New York. We have 4 of them on the ASVAB. So we're kind of close to an administrative rule in New York to protect children from, you know, these predators. And then, you know, just more nuts and bolts about the opt-out or the firing ranges. You know, I think the firing ranges are really important. So if you come down to this page and you'll see a Jay Rotzi program shooting filthy commercial ranges. I think there are about 8,000 commercial firing ranges now. Here's another thing you might want to get into as far as really vulnerable members of the population. 4-H, Boy Scouts, and young Marines all shoot in marksmanship programs, along with the Jay Rotzi kids, at commercial firing ranges. And a lot of the commercial fire ranges are not, inspected. And so the Seattle Times did an expose on loaded, it's called Loaded with Lead. And they showed, like, you know, one kid just on his arm, you know, like laying on the floor. Also, National Guard armories are coated with lead as well. And so a lot of the Boy Scouts and the Jay Rotzi programs will shoot there. And, you know, we have one National Guard, regulation that says when you can see the lead, it's time to clean it up, you know. So, but these are children, you know, and there are sleepovers. In the state of Alabama, going to have a sleepover in the National Guard armory after a shooting match, you know. But it's a cultural thing, and the problem is that they look at a guy like me, and they put me in a category of way radical liberal guy who has an agenda. And they're right. You know? But, you know, the agenda also happens to, you know, protect human health. So let me take you to civilian exposure here. .org. Bam. Okay, so they have my stuff up, and thank you for that. You know, the highlighted bases. And please, there's a lot here that I didn't, you know, of course, get a chance to talk about. But if you go to the Civilian Exposure website, I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to put a page or two together for press releases to each individual town here, you know. So, you know, just the China Lakes, and, you know, this is people at Cannon Air Force Base, and then, you know, the former Dallas Air Station. They had a fish kill here. Everything alive in that lake just came up floating dead. I mean, it just reaches a point where, you know, things die. And this is the worst. This is England Air Force Base in Louisiana, where, you know, the levels were at 10,970,000, but pretty bad stuff. And then this is Cocoa Beach, where Holly and I are going to stay for a night. And so we're going to get a kayak, and we're going to ride around. But, you know, these chemicals we're talking about, they don't smell, and you can't taste them, and there's no odor, and, you know, you can't see them. Oh, you know, maybe. Yeah, while we go kayaking? Yeah. Okay, this is kind of interesting, too. I don't know, you probably can't see it right here, but, you know, it just says that the burn pit, you know, is right here. This is the base, and this is the area that the Navy is testing near, where are we, Jacksonville. And so they sent letters to everybody, and there was a notice in the newspaper which then disappeared. And I've been able to track a dozen towns where the notice is initially given, and then it just disappears. So you never know, you know, what the results of the testing were. But what is even more amazing here is I've noticed, too, that all of the burn pits are at the edge of the bases where the winds take it away and sprinkle it over neighboring communities. And that's the case here. We saw it today. So at Richards Bar, you know, it's right on the edge of the base and right on the edge where the winds can take it away from the base. They know what they're doing. I mean, if you had a military base and had 5,000 acres and you wanted to have a giant poisonous burn pit, where would you put it? Away, right? So that's pretty horrible.
I want to make sure I heard you correctly earlier. So the city of Belton's water has a PFAS level of...
we don't know.
Oh, okay. I thought you cited a number.
Five things that were on a database, environmental working group, and it had five chemicals that were above their levels,
but
not
PFAS. Okay, so yeah... So, what are there efforts underway to determine what that is, or are people more focused on real, you know, working bases?
Yeah, I mean, it's you and me, Mike, you know, and everybody in this room, and no one's talking about Belton except us in here. And I don't know anything about it. I haven't done any research on it. I just went to the environmental working group, and I knew that there was a page on their website that allows you to put in the zip code of where you are to see what the water is like. And that's all we did. And then what prompted that was when Ann said that she had a friend who lived in Belton who died of thyroid cancer. And thyroid cancer is like linked to this stuff. So I figured, well, what the hell? I put the zip code in there, and five chemicals were shown to be above the levels, and they cause cancer.
And could you repeat those chemicals again?
Oh, man.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I will find it. I was going to play the Traveling Wilburys, which, man, yeah. Well, Tom Petty's lines here. Hang on, let me see if I can do this. And I don't know if I have the Belton thing. Do you live near Belton?
I live in Kansas City, which is
near Belton.
Yeah.
A neighboring community.
Yeah. Belton's part of our constituency, my constituency.
So in several places across the country, and I'll get to your question, the contaminated burn sites were turned into golf courses. Okay? And that's the case here. And so I don't know where Tom Petty was coming from. I believe he wrote this song. But what they did in, in Jacksonville is somebody had the brilliant idea to all of the PFAS, all of that groundwater from the base was pumped to the adjacent golf course, which was then put into a pond, which was then allowed to sprinkle the golf course, okay? And so listen to Tom Petty's words. While you're strolling down the fairway, showing no remorse, glowing from the poisons they've sprayed on your golf course, while you're busy sinking birdies and keeping your scorecard, the devil's been busy in your backyard. Tom Petty. And that intent, now the Belton thing. I hate it when that happens, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, hang on. Control C. Let me throw this thing in here. And thanks for being patient, people. Okay. Here we go. 7 contaminants detected above health guidelines. Includes chemicals detected in 2015. Bio bromodichloromethane cancer, chloroform cancer, chromium hexavalent cancer, dichloroacetic acid, and total trihalomethanes cancer causing. And it said includes chemicals detected under the EPA's unregulated contaminant monitoring rule program, for which the annual utility averages exceeded a health guideline established by federal or state public health authority. So apparently these 5 chemicals exceed either state.
No, you.
Me. Oh, sorry. 5 chemicals in Belton that exceed health standards that, you know, and they cause cancer. And we only stumbled on it because, you know, Ann had mentioned she had a friend who died of thyroid cancer who lived in Belton, which isn't more than a mile from our PFOS stuff. But this is, what do you call it? Not circumstantial, but what kind of evidence is it called? Were you...
anecdotal?
Yeah, anecdotal. Thank you, lawyer. Damn. Yeah, anecdotal, right. So anecdotal doesn't fly, you know? And so you need the data, and unfortunately it's Dow and DuPont and the military that hold the data. But what they have released, man, is pretty damning. It's enough. It's enough. You would think it would be enough. So what, Environmental Working Group. Hang on, you guys, okay? So you saw civilian exposure and you saw student privacy. So let me see if I can get this. You ever heard of these folks? They're just... Thanks, Mike. Yeah, they're excellent. So you can search, PFAS. Look at this. Up to 110 million Americans could have PFAS contaminated drinking water, and so they show a Teflon pan. It was used for Teflon. Now these are small levels, but it's possible. You know how sometimes, you know, you'll cut a Teflon pan with a knife and it scores it. Well, that's the PFAS, and that gets into your bloodstream. So, but this is a good work site here. Anything else? Yeah.
I just had a question. I'm trying to get up the courage too, because there's going to be an EPA meeting next week, and it's about the Clean Water Act. And you have like 3 minutes to talk. Yeah. I don't know if I can do it because it'll be my first time to do something like this. Would it be a good idea to bring up maybe Belton and the contaminated water? Or I'm trying to figure out what to say to make some kind of impact, because it'll be on record whether they do anything about it or not.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I left it out completely. In 1972, Congress passed the Clean Water Act, okay? And the Clean Water Act covered ephemeral streams. An ephemeral stream is a stream that dries up for a part of the year. So when you think about it, you know, you have all these little baby streams, and they might be a mile or two long, and then they at one point, you know, they get strong enough and wide enough that they never dry up, and then they go into a larger stream and then into the rivers. Okay, so in 72, the regulation said, hey, we have several hundred contaminants that you can't put into even these ephemeral streams, okay? Because we know that 6 months down the road, when it becomes the rainy season, you know, it's going to flush into other areas, okay? And so the Trump administration last week, okay, sent out a memo. And the memo said that we fully recognize that the ephemeral stream component of the Clean Water Act, which was strengthened by the Obama administration, is a, quote, power grab by Democrats. Okay? So what it means basically is, let's say you make concrete, and there are certain phosphates or certain biochemicals that, you know, from the process of making the concrete, fall into those streams. You have to get rid of it, you know. You got a factory going, and you squirt it out, and it goes into those streams. So if the Trump administration has its way, those pollutants will be allowed into your Missouri River, okay? And not just that, but if you're a chicken farmer, you won't have to build the berms. You won't have to take care of the, you know, the stuff that flows into. So that's a major component. I would ask them, I would say, I know Kansas, and I know Missouri, and I know things get dry. I see my land. And I think the ephemeral part of the Clean Water Act makes us very vulnerable at this part of the country. I'm in Maryland. We, you know, our streams don't dry up, but they do here, and I would say that. And then also I would say that that would be the first part of my 3 minutes, and I would write it down. And if you want, you know, email me, and don't freak out. Just read it. Read the damn thing, you know? And really, and have two parts of it. You know, the first one would be the ephemeral streams. The second part would be, when do you think you could get around to establishing minimum contaminant levels, MCLs? We need MCLs for PFAS, you know, so that you can begin to regulate the stuff, and also demand that you know the PFAS content in jurisdictions where you live. Like, you want to know.
That's a good question, because one of the things that I understand, for instance, farmers, that they will only test the soil or the water at certain times during the year. They will not test it right after they put down their chemicals, agricultural farmers is what I'm talking about. Yeah. So then they'll say, well, okay, it's not that contaminated because this is the numbers, but they didn't test it. They only test it certain times a year. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. It's kind of like PERC tests, you know?
Right.
I don't know if you know about that stuff, but those are the two things.
Okay.
Michael?
No.
Yeah.
Leave it to like one last question because we have to put our chairs back and be out of here.
And then we got two questions.
Okay. Excuse me. I was wondering if you would have any test kits or ways in which we might be able to test water in a particular stream, and how would we go about that? Is there any advice on me individually testing or purchasing a test?
Well, in Maryland and in more progressive states, you simply go to your health department and ask them for a test kit, and it's free. I don't know what the deal is here, but I would think that it would not be free, and I would think that they'd look at you and go, you want to do what? I mean, really, there's a different culture here than where I come from. We have better schools, and we have better water, and we have better soil. Things are more regulated in Maryland generally than they are here.
What would I ask the department to test?
The levels of PFAS in your water. And not just your tap water, but also you want to know the levels in your municipality, and then you want to know the well water, when the groundwater, how you'll see like the road and then there's it'll rain for a couple days and then the groundwater kind of comes up, test that like that, the surface water. So it's surface water, groundwater, tap water. Those are the three. And it matters because the fish eat it and the birds eat it and all the nature around you, all the living organisms around you become poisoned by this stuff forever. So we want to know.
Thank you, Pat. You are wonderfully alarming. I was just wondering if we all resort to bottled water. What do we do with all this plastic? We're screwed. Yeah. Have any response?
I don't know. I wouldn't drink well water anymore. I just wouldn't. And also, even if you get it from a municipality, I would buy, a $75 water filter kit. Especially if you are a young woman who may get pregnant. It's just not worth it.
Chris has had her hand up previously.
Okay.
Hi.
I would like to hear more about what you're going to do when you go to all the bases, and I think it's wonderfully creative. And how can we in Kansas City support you or get the word out?
Around. And nothing else is going to get me any attention. Well, at least that would get me arrested and I could get, I'm going to have a podium and it'll say England Air Force Base behind me. And, we will, we got a podium. Holly has it in her car when she picks me up at LA airport tomorrow night, and I'll stand there with the podium, and then I have a civilian exposure banner. It's about 2 feet by 2 feet, and it shows the logo of civilian exposure and the website, and she'll have a the cell phone, and we have a broom handle jamming to the ground with some duct tape so that she can film it without jiggling all around. And then we'll go Facebook Live. And then we have, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, World Beyond War, Civilian Exposure, and several others, that we've sent it out to. I sent it out to my list of about 350 people that I know, you know, and asked them to send it around and, you know, just hope that some people cover it. And then I sent press releases, you know, with the link to the civilian exposure site to all of the Gannett people that have written on it across the country. You know, Huffington Post, New York Times, Washington Post, but also all of the small local papers and all of the 8 bases that I've, but I haven't gotten anything back from anyone. Well, you know, it's military. These are military towns.
So you're not going to be on the base doing this?
Really maybe somebody like, somebody like Henry or Ann, they would do that. Well, no, I'm going to be in front of the base. But look for me. I mean, I think if you Google it, you know, million point tour, PPT tour, you should be able to find it on Facebook and you know, and then send it around.
That was activist Pat Elder speaking at All Souls UU Church last week. Pat is embarking on a tour of the most toxic military bases with regard to PFAS. For more of our coverage of PFAS, check out the most recent Eco Radio KC podcasts at kkfi.org. And look for, in the near future, Craig Lubow's interview with Pat Elder to be aired on this program.
All right, this is Craig Lubow, and thank you for joining us here on Eco Radio KC. Today I have Bob Grove with me. Bob is the founder of Climate Council of Greater Kansas City. He was formerly with the Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club and recently formed this organization, and this is a resource organization. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Craig. Founder, I mean, obviously, I was one of the instigators, but actually a group of us got together. You know, the work I was doing previously as a climate advocate, as an environmental lobbyist, gave me the opportunity to meet a lot of great people throughout the metro area. And we all kind of had common needs for resources and avenues of sharing our information and our different advocacies. So we kind of set up this group to provide that umbrella for us that let us do our environmental work more effectively.
What groups are involved?
That's difficult to say. That's changing on a daily basis. The best way to find out who's partnered with the groups is go to the website, climatecouncilgkc.org, and look at our partners page. We see new people coming online with us every day of the week. So, you know, go there and see what's happening.
And what would you describe as the need that this is fulfilling?
Well, as an environmental advocate, you know, there's a lot of things that I have been able to do that I wanted to share with others. It's a way of reaching out to a broader audience and network with other advocates. The partners with the Climate Council are able to bring their events, their news items, and their programming to a central website that we all share and make that available to all of our various memberships. People that subscribe to the website, to the Climate Council, will get a weekly digest of all the environmental events that are coming up in the following week and all news items that have been posted to the site in the previous week. So it's kind of a one-stop place to go to find out what environmental things are happening throughout the Kansas City metro area on both sides of the state line.
And what is the overall mission of the organization?
The big issue or the big mission is to reduce global warming. Now, bear in mind that we're a nonpartisan, non-political group. We're not here to argue what created global warming or any of those political issues. We just recognize that we all are concerned about having a healthy environment, clean water, clean air, being able to survive on a long-term basis. And global warming is affecting all of us. regardless of our political, regardless of what we think caused that. So, you know, we want to set that aside, and we want to work on solutions to global warming.
All right. And so your focus on is going to shift in the past, and even now a lot of organizations are focused on, I don't know if this is the best way to say it, but finger pointing at what has caused global warming.
Yes, and I think there needs to be a modality change there. Those are valid arguments, and let them have them. But I'm not interested in participating in them. I really want to be more focused on solutions. And, you know, we come at global warming from two sides. One is the greenhouse gas reduction. Obviously, if we don't contribute to global warming, that will slow it down. Another very important issue is the sequestration, the drawdown aspects of removing carbon from the air. So both of those combined together are necessary to create an environment where we will have a stable climate and, you know, a safe, healthy place for our children and grandchildren to live.
Right. And for those listeners who maybe missed my show where we had people from Drawdown, give us just a little bit of background on that. I understand the goal is to actually not just stop global warming from accelerating, but reverse it.
Absolutely. I'm certainly not the expert on Drawdown, but we have partners that are. Drawdown is basically a list of 80 items, 80 actions that actually remove carbon, greenhouse gases from the air, sequesters it back into the soil, or, you know, other things that reverse global warming. So you think about the issues of stopping greenhouse gas emissions. Those are important. But the long-term goal of reversing the damage we've already done and moving back to a more favorable climate. I mean, if we just stopped greenhouse gas emissions now, we're still in a climate scenario that's warmer than normal. We've got these massive storms, as we just had here in Kansas City, that I'm personally not very used to. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of weather activity that's not normal long-term.
It's going to be a broad-based focus that goes beyond global warming. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The Climate Council is not really a group with its own agenda. The Climate Council has been created to facilitate all the other groups throughout the metro area that have their individual actions. And, you know, within that umbrella, we obviously have the Drawdown group and, you know, those groups that are trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, either through renewable energy or mass transit. We're also looking at recycling issues, composting, clean air, clean water. We're basically a big umbrella that's welcoming anybody that's in the environmental sector to join us.
Right. And will the type of messaging change? I know you said it's going to focus on solutions. And what I mean by this question is that oftentimes it seems like the environmental groups have focused entirely on global warming, and that they're not going after or messaging to get other people to come in. And, you know, you have situations, you have air quality, you have toxins and mercury and health impacts. And some people in the environmental movement have argued that they should be focusing on those more than the terminology of using global warming, because if you solve those issues, you really start to solve global warming, because it's the same solutions on a lot of those.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very good observation. I welcome everybody at the table. As I said earlier, if you're working on the environment, on any of this, please join us at the table. I don't see us as focused on anything. The idea of using global warming as an umbrella issue, I think is valid because ultimately all of these issues affect global warming. You know, we play with the concept of climate change versus global warming. We feel that climate change is something that happens. I mean, the climate is always going to change. Global warming is specifically the issue that's causing our weather patterns, you know, security issues, and the things that we can address as human beings. So we kind of look at that as our umbrella, but it's a big umbrella. And we welcome everything. We, you know, insulate your buildings. Let's look at toxins. I mean, water pollution, air pollution is a big deal for me. Waste products, you know, landfills, plastics, renewables. If you go to our website and look at our news feed, you'll see articles on there right now about sustainable food, you know, how diet choices can affect the environment. You'll look at, I think I saw a recent article on zero waste, you know, how to replace plastics in your daily life. So we're looking at a lot of different ways to affect different aspects of your life that will all add up to the big umbrella of global warming. But, you know, we don't have to use that as the end all. I mean, let's look at all these individual actions and bring everybody together to work on those.
And for those who maybe aren't really familiar with exactly how plastics affect global warming, first, I suppose we would want them to understand that it's made from oil. It's an oil byproduct. So how does that contribute to global warming in terms of the production of plastics?
I'm not the expert there, but I'll certainly share my ideas. I mean, as you said, it is a petroleum-based product, so we have all the drilling and aspects that go into that. More importantly, I think, is the disposal of the plastics. You know, any sort of incineration or destruction of those is going to produce greenhouse gases. Probably more importantly is them just staying in the environment and the toxic effect they have on this. Mm-hmm. Is there a direct correlation between them and global warming? I suppose it's probably less than some of the other things, like burning coal for electricity. You know, that obviously releases a lot of greenhouse gases. You know, using a plastics, maybe not releasing as much, but eventually those will end up in a landfill. You know, we're seeing those enter our marine, our water environments, you know, affecting the fish we eat, you know, other products, you know, food products that end up with plastics embedded with them. So it's just kind of the overall health issue there. And I think, I mean, you raised a question earlier, is this all about global warming? No. I mean, obviously some things are directly linked to global warming. A lot of these other things are smaller aspects of quality of life, and certainly our landfills, which produce methane and greenhouse gases. So, I mean, we have an incentive to eliminate landfills as much as possible, but really just the pollution in the streams, the pollution to our food systems, and the general impact on our health overall is what we're trying to help with.
You mentioned the methane and food sources, and methane is actually as bad, and some argue worse, than CO2. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. From what, and again, I'm not the expert there, so, but you know, my reading and what people have told me, I mean, you're seeing 30, 40 times the greenhouse gas effect from a methane or some of the other heavy gases. Refrigerants is one of the big issues, particularly from the drawdown. You know, the release of refrigerants in the air have a magnified effect on global warming. So if we can do reductions on those, that has a much bigger impact than, you know, reducing CO2. And they're all important, but obviously we focus our resources and where they can have the greatest impact.
I had attended that drawdown workshop with you.
Wasn't that a great event?
And one of the questions, because you just mentioned refrigerants.
Uh-huh.
I had always thought, and apparently I was incorrect, that all the really the two or three worst refrigerants have been banned by the government. Is that not correct?
Again, I'm not the expert. I'll keep saying that, just you know, right. It's a caveat here. I'm not the expert, but my understanding is, yeah, we have banned many of those. That doesn't mean that the replacements have – well, the replacements are obviously better, but they still have an impact. Okay. And any refrigerant we're going to use, which is a dense-based gas, is going to infect the atmosphere. The issues are eliminating the need for refrigerants where possible – where not possible, making sure we're using systems that don't leak, make sure that when we refresh those systems, get maintenance, that you know the old gases are being disposed of properly. And I understand that the science community is actually working on new refrigerant gases that will not have greenhouse gas effects. I don't know that those are available yet, and obviously they'll be costly when they're first created. But I think our long-term goal is to move to refrigerant systems that don't have the kind of atmospheric impact that our current ones do.
You mentioned solutions. In terms of the food issues and the contribution that our, not just food waste, but
our diet choices.
Agricultural issues. Mm-hmm. What are the solutions that you're aware of that are being proposed that might help reverse global warming?
There's actually a good presentation on the council's website called Sustainable Food, How What We Eat Impacts the Environment. They make some really good observations on what types of food have the greatest greenhouse gas effect. So, you know, certain products produce more greenhouse gas than others. So shifting your diet from, to help eliminate some of the higher greenhouse gas products can have a big effect. Just moving, and, you know, we discuss, you know, pescatarian, you know, eat fish versus beef or become vegan or any of those combinations. I really don't advocate any of those one over the other. You can have whatever type of diet you want, but within your diet, if you can just be more selective in what products you eat, you can have a very important effect in reducing greenhouse gases. And you know, it seems small, but, you know, if we look across the entire population, if everybody took that one small step, it would have a massive effect. I saw an article recently that made the case that if everybody just substituted a serving of beef with a serving of beans, so, you know, just replace your beef with beans, that would solve 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions. Just that one change. Go ahead and eat everything else you want, you know, chicken, pork, fish. And I'm not criticizing the beef industry, obviously, but just that one comparison of beans versus beef. Eat normally, just that one serving of beef, have a serving of beans instead. Yeah, we've pretty much solved 80% of our greenhouse gas emission problems. More importantly, if we just looked at a doctor-recommended diet. So we have the way Americans eat, which is large portions and lots of them. We have the doctor-recommended diet, which is like a 4-ounce serving of meat with your green vegetables and your fruits, you know, balanced diet. And then you get into the vegan diets and, you know, the more extreme solutions, which are very good, but not everybody's going to want to do that. But just moving from the way Americans traditionally eat to a healthy diet will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 40%. That's pretty amazing when you think about that. So just the food choices we make as personal individuals can have a big impact.
And so poultry products and pork products, do those contribute less than beef?
Well, you're setting me up here. Get people mad at me. If you look at the data, the beef industry produces the highest amount of greenhouse gas. You'll see that poultry chicken is below that, but still relatively high. Fish a little bit below that. And then all your vegetable products are massively below all of those.
This organization, tell me, what is the difference between this and the traditional coalition?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I mean, that's a lot of people define coalitions differently. In a way, this is a coalition, and in some ways it's not. I mean, it's a coalition in that we're trying to bring a lot of people to the table and work together. The synergy of sharing resources and sharing networks makes all of us more effective. So when we talk about partnering with other groups and individuals that are environmental advocates, we're talking about them bringing their programs, their events, and sharing them with each other. So in a way, this is an opportunity for us to network and share resources. I mean, obviously, there's economies to be had in posting everything to a common calendar, to share the news feeds, to be able to create a list of programs, you know, educational programs that our consumers and public can come to and see what's available. The complementary side of that is our subscribers. By subscribing to the Climate Council, you'll get a weekly digest that shows you all the environmental events that are coming up in the next week. Plus, it'll show you all the news items that have been posted since the last. So it's kind of a way to get a weekly digest reminder of environmental opportunities, you know, events you may want to attend, news articles you might want to read, keep you up to speed with the latest of what's happening environmentally. Plus, it's a way to engage. It's a way to actually go to rallies, go to trainings and workshops. The other thing we have on the Climate Council is our educational catalog. And this is geared more towards groups, clubs, organizations, municipalities, you know, cities, any body of people that would like to have a speaker come in and address any of these issues. We have a sustainable food presentation on there that addresses a lot of the things you and I just talked about in terms of what we eat and how we can affect greenhouse gases by choosing. We've got the drawdown workshops on there. We have a presentation by Brigadier General Chris King, where he talks about the strategic security impacts of global warming. And there he's looking at how global warming is going to affect the environment, loss of water in certain regions, you know, desertification in certain regions, and how that's going to create large migrations of people out of these unlivable areas to others, and how that impacts our borders and the security. So, I mean, we're looking at the immigration, you know, forced immigration, because these people can no longer survive in the region they live in. And, you know, climate change is going to have a big impact on that. We have to look at how it's going to impact our security as individual nations.
And what are some of the solutions the group would be advocating for clean air, clean water, and those issues?
We are a 501c3 nonprofit. So obviously our mission is to educate through partnerships and advocacy. We bring all the solutions to the table. The Climate Council itself doesn't offer solutions, but our partners do. You know, we act as that point of contact where you as a subscriber can come in and see a wide range of educational opportunities and the solutions offered by that. I'll use drawdown as an example again, since we obviously are talking about that. The drawdown intro will explain. It's a workshop, and it will explain all of these options you have in your personal life of taking action as an individual or as a community to remove greenhouse gases from the environment, so actually reverse global warming. You can come to the website, and you can actually, as a group or a club, you can actually request a presentation, and we will connect you with a speaker and set that up for them to come out and talk to your group. And these are always free. Everything we put on our website is free educational programs, events, and stuff that you can tap into as a subscriber. The flip side of that is, of course, our partners. So we're providing an outlet for them to get their educational knowledge and solutions, which was your question. What are the solutions? We're creating this environment where our partners can get their solutions to people. So in a way, we are working to connect the consumers with the providers being our environmental partners and the consumers being anybody that's concerned about the environment and where we move forward from here. A lot of that's educational.
And so the organization is focusing more on providing solutions for the consumer and the people locally, as opposed to maybe providing some kind of education resources for some of the manufacturing sectors.
That's true. I mean, we're looking at a subscriber base that's individuals and groups of individuals throughout the metropolitan area. The nonprofit works on both sides of the state line, and we are focused on the KC Metro. So, I mean, that's a fairly large area. What were we talking earlier? 14 counties, 150 municipalities. So, you know, that's a lot of work. But, you know, it's a way for us to bring together resources here locally instead of focusing on a large national campaign that can kind of lose focus on what's happening at home.
Okay. And is this like the first organization of this type? Or are there other organizations?
Oh, I expect there's others. There's always, we always reinvent the wheel. You know, the world is, I've never done anything in my life that I didn't later discover, oh, they did that back in the Mesopotamian period. And, you know, so we learn from everybody else. I'm sure there's a lot of groups doing this. In my personal work, and, you know, I did come to this looking at existing groups throughout the metro area to see who I could partner with to effectively do my own personal work as an environmental advocate. And I really didn't find the right combination of resources that I needed. So in a lot of ways, my choice was to create something for myself. But in talking to all these other groups, I discovered that they also had very similar needs. So that's where we all got together and founded this thing together, to satisfy all of our needs. There's no point in creating a separate group for Bob and a separate group for Drawdown and, you know, and our 30, 40 other groups for all these other, when we can share a website, when we can share a calendar, share a news feed, share an educational catalog. The advantage of that is that it's cheaper for all of us to go to this one place instead of duplicating resources. And the second advantage is that our subscribers come to this one place and they see what everybody's offering. It's not going to, you know, 30, 40 different websites to see what they can get and what they can learn. And you mentioned solutions. I mean, 30, 40 different websites all have great solutions. But here's one catalog you can go down and look at speakers from all these organizations and draw from that. Or here's one calendar that you can see all these different groups' events coming up in the next few weeks. So I think it works for everybody.
If an organization wants to partner with you, How do they approach that?
Or just reach out to us. If they go to the website, go to the About Us page that shows our partners, and there's actually a button on there. They can just, you know, click that, contact us, you know, tell us what they're doing, what kind of programming they'd like to share, and, you know, we'll hook them up. It's a fairly easy process. I mean, all this is free. We set this up as a nonprofit, obviously, and we're doing minimal fundraising to support the infrastructure and such. But, you know, we're not charging our partners anything for this. I mean, this is a service that we want to perform to support our own advocacy. And, you know, the more people we bring into this, the more partners that are sharing this advocacy, the greater our effect. So that's just a free service that we're wanting to do to help the environment. And on the flip side, the subscribers, that's always free. I mean, sign up when you want to, unsubscribe when you want to. There's no solicitation. We're not going to sell your information. We're not going to spam your email box. It's just this opportunity for you to see what's going on environmentally and participate in any way you want. Again, free, because what all of our concerns are is making the environment a better place for all of us. And we do that by sharing this as broadly as possible. So nobody within the council or the council itself is not profiting off of any of this. This is just a shared nonprofit resource that anybody can take advantage of. If you want to partner, by all means, come and hit the partner button and, you know, we'll share all this information with you. And you say go and you're a partner. If you're a subscriber or become a subscriber. If you're an individual that wants to be active in environmental issues, just come and sign up. You know, give us your email address, basically, and we'll start sending you these weekly digests that show you everything that's going on and connect you up with these individual partners of ours and let you get involved. So very simple.
And each of the partners can contribute to the news feed, is that correct?
Absolutely.
In the calendar?
Absolutely.
And how is that done? Do they send it to you and then it gets posted, or do they all post things themselves?
Our partners have, they typically designate a person, but, you know, their liaison, whatever, has access to our systems to where they can post news articles, you know, update the calendar. The programming listing items, a little bit more complicated. You know, we talk to them and we set up that page for them. But, you know, still, we're not here to judge what you do. We just want to make sure it's environmentally proactive, and we'll get you on the site.
And are there any partner organizations that have signed on yet who are focused, if not entirely, at least to a significant extent, on sustainability issues from the perspective of population issues?
I don't think there has. That's an interesting concept. I would love to see that. You know, one of the 80 drawdowns, and again, I'm not the expert here. I always put that caveat out there. But I recall one of the most significant drawdowns is in terms of educating girls and women, because through that education, that affects population growth. And obviously, controlling population is going to have an impact on the environment. So, you know, that's something that they're interested in.
All right. And I don't know if this is something you've ever looked at before, but I've done a lot of research on population. It seems like one of the big things, as you mentioned, is educating women. And statistically, the higher the educational level, the lower the birth rate.
Mm-hmm. I was actually surprised when I saw that. I was reading through the drawdown book and at the workshop, and I was.
Have you seen anything that says anything about the educational level of men and the effect of men on population rate?
Well, I would think that would be good for all of us, you know. So I think we should all be educated about environmental issues, and we should all be treated as equal members of the table. So I think that's a difficult subject. I think it's important that we are all educated environmentally, and that we all have a high enough education that we can make good choices for ourselves and for our communities. And I think certainly some cultures around the world, women don't have that opportunity to have that education. And in some cultures, the men may not have enough education to realize the value of bringing educated women to the table. So it's important that we pursue that. I am far from the expert on that. And, you know, I'm so excited to see all the new women we have in Congress. And so many of them are pro-environmental issues. So, you know, it's really been great to see the Me Too movement step up and move women to the forefront of our political agenda. So I'm excited about that, and I'm expecting to see some great things. And, you know, they could speak to this so much better than I, so, you know, let's find one of them to come and talk to you about it.
You previously, when you were with Sierra Club, did some lobbying.
Uh-huh.
Is that something this organization will also engage in at all?
I plan to continue my work, so my own advocacy, and I've spent a lot of time in Jefferson City and with the city councils and various groups talking to them about both, you know, clean water, clean air, but, you know, certainly getting into renewable power, mass transit. So that kind of lobbying that I've done, and I'm not a professional lobbyist, I'm an amateur, you know, what do you call that, a citizen lobby. So, you know, I will go to Jefferson City and talk to my reps and other people's reps. I will go to Jefferson City or the city council with groups of other citizens like me, and we'll talk to them as a group. So that's something that I will continue doing in my personal advocacy. And the Climate Council basically provides me the structure to do that. So when I'm planning a road trip to Jefferson City, That will appear on our calendar, and I'll invite other people to join me for that.
Is there an educational component to this as far as educating people about pending legislation in Kansas and Missouri and what they can do if they want to be active on legislative issues?
Absolutely. That's something that's dear to my heart. So, I mean, that's something that I'm taking a lead on, and, you know, I welcome other people to participate with me on that. So we certainly stay aware of all the legislation that's moving through our various municipalities and states, and those that are harmful to the environment, we want to be able to make the public aware of that. I will be posting articles to our news blog specifically looking at those local legislation that we may want to support or oppose from an environmental, nonpartisan, non-political point of view. And, you know, putting that article up there allows people to understand, be educated about what is happening, and then to make the decision to call their personal representative or senator and, you know, encourage them to vote one way or the other. And in some instances where it's really strong legislation that we feel we need a physical presence, then we can get together on that calendar and put a bunch of us in cars and go to Jefferson City or City Hall or Topeka and, you know, actually get in front of our representatives and discuss these issues with them.
Besides the food issues and they talked about the refrigerants, what are some of the other key things that people can do to help solve these problems?
Go to LED lights in your house. I was reading an article again the other day that talked about a 20% cost savings by just replacing your standard light bulbs with the new LEDs. And those have become much cheaper in recent years. The author of this article is indicating that they had just replaced all the light bulbs in their home, and the savings was such that they paid for the replacements in 3 months. And then going forward, obviously, you know, their electric bills are quite a bit smaller. So if we just did that nationwide, that's a 20% reduction right there. So that's exciting. So, you know, your food choice, your choice of LEDs, certainly insulation. You know, there's a lot of groups out there and partners that are looking at how we improve our building structures so they're more tight, they're more economically sound. I mean, those are the individual things. The other thing you can do is engage at more of a community level, you know, working on our legislation, the lobbying thing we were just talking about, talking to your representatives and senators, meeting them locally. I think people are a little intimidated by their government representatives, but those people are so accessible. I've met with so many of those just here in town. I mean, you go to a coffee shop and you sit down and talk to them, and they're interested to know what you have to say because you're their constituent. And obviously, you're interested in knowing where they stand on issues. So it's a win-win for everybody. And by getting to know your representative, having coffee with them, you actually build a relationship there that lets you become active in government. So that's a wonderful thing that we're working on. I'm trying to think. There's so many things we're doing right now. And this is really, the council's evolving. I mean, this is relatively new. We started this 3-4 months ago. It's evolving. I mean, every day we get new partners. Every day our subscriber base increases. The ideas that you've put forward in our discussion here may be something that we can implement next week. So we're meeting regularly with our core steering committee and with our broader group of partners to see what they need, what they recommend, and we're trying to find ways to address those. So for me, it's kind of a two-pronged thing. I'm still wanting to do my own advocacy, mm-hmm. and obviously, you know, put a lot of time into that, but I'm also dedicating a fairly significant amount of my time right now in progressing this council and taking everybody's ideas and implementing them so that, you know, a few months from now, as this thing reaches its full potential, we'll have a very powerful tool and network that we can all benefit from.
Of course, a couple of things that I did think of in terms of solution is at least as far as energy production, would be wind and solar, but wind is more broad-based. I don't think anybody can do anything individually. Nobody's going to have a wind farm in their backyard.
Not a farm. You could certainly put a generator up there, but, you know, I've got trees in my yard, so I don't know how effective that would be. Certainly at the municipal level, and we are talking to various cities and advocating that they get involved with the new KCPL green tariffs. I mean, KCPL is now packaging renewable energy into a tariff for, you know, municipalities and large corporations, universities and such. So one of my personal actions and that of a lot of my colleagues is working with cities to encourage them to take advantage of that. You know, we worked with the new KCI. You know, we're putting in this new airport and making sure that's going to be using the LED lights and, you know, low flow water. And I don't think they're going to have a plant on site, but they're certainly subscribing to KCPL's tariff. So they'll be burning the green energy and looking at a lot of ways to make those big institutions sustainable. You know, we're looking at the streetcar and expanding that to make mass transit available so we can reduce the number of cars on the road. You know, make it easier for individuals to commute from their home to their job or to shopping or, you know, just find opportunities to share that mass transit instead of everybody hopping in their car and sitting in gridlock for an hour to get to some place that you could just buzz to in an effective train. So there's a lot of things we're working on. So individually, you know, those small things of your home, your lighting, your choice of food, your choice of appliances, but then joining that larger community that lets you advocate for better legislation, better actions, encouraging your city, your municipality, your county to purchase the, you know, the renewable energy, looking at both wind farms that are going to apply more to these large organizations like cities and the universities, but certainly the solar cells, the solar options that we can put on our roof, or the solar farms that are bringing up, you know, coming up in our communities, looking at these little community-based solar farms that we can subscribe to. You know, Independence is a great role model there. I mean, there's pros and cons. Obviously, there's politics anywhere you go, but I think they've done a great job in moving their coal-based plants to solar options and, you know, going to the LED lighting throughout the city. I mean, they're taking a proactive stance, which, you know, step forward, step back. You know, it's a difficult path, but they're moving ahead. And I'm excited that Kansas City's right behind them. You know, they went through their clean energy feasibility study with the items on there. And I was at that meeting, and they came back to report that all of their initiatives were feasible in you know, a short number of years. It wasn't like, yeah, we'll do this in 50 years. A lot of those things came back and said, well, yeah, KCPL has this renewable option, you know, going through the Public Services Commission at that point. But, you know, they've moved through that, and they're ready to start buying that. So instead of buying coal-based power, they can start buying the wind power. So they're taking those actions. And we as individuals can get involved in encouraging our government entities to take the same actions that we're seeing effective in Independence, in Kansas City, and in many other places.
BPU is, mm-hmm, has a solar panel farm.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, everybody's moving in that direction. It's incumbent on us as individuals to make sure that momentum continues forward, to support those that are doing it and to encourage those that aren't to go ahead and start taking the steps that the leaders are.
All right. And I think we're just about out of time.
Oh, very
so
good.
I want to thank you for being here. For those just joining us, we've been talking to Bob Grove. He's the founder and president of Climate Council of Greater Kansas City. If you'll give that website one more time.
Sure. Go to climatecouncilgkc.org. You know, if you're a environmental advocate, a group, or an individual, please see about partnering with us. We'd love to share our resources with you. If you're an individual that wants to get involved, please subscribe to the Climate Council so that we can send you our little weekly digest of all the events and programming that's available throughout the metro area.
The calendar of events for the week of 225. On February 26th at 6 p.m. on Radioactive Magazine, Dante Glenniecki, the Emergency Preparedness Management for the City of Independence, speaks on how to survive the natural disasters most likely to occur in the Kansas City area, winter storms, tornadoes, and floods. On 226, the Big Muddy Speaker Series features a brief history of the Blue River in Kansas City, 7 p.m. at the Westport Coffee House, Kansas City, Missouri. On Wednesday, February 27th, will be a session of the public hearing on the waters of the United States by the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Army. This will be held at the Reardon Convention Center, 520 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. The Wednesday session will convene at 4 p.m. and conclude no later than 8 p.m. They're having another hearing session on Thursday, February 28th. The session will convene at 9 a.m. and conclude no later than noon. Sierra Club is hosting a room at Garden Hilton next door on Minnesota Avenue, and KKFI will be there to record the public comments. On February 28th, 12 noon on Sprouts, KKFI, Catherine Flowers, founder of the Alabama Center for Rural Enterprise and a senior fellow at the Center for Earth Ethics, tells of their work to get Alabama's Black Belt equal access to basic resources like clean water and sewage disposal. On March 1st, 9:30 a.m. on Bioneers, KKFI will play the world-renowned co-father of green chemistry, John Warner. The Sierra Club is hosting a hike on the 4.5-mile George Lathrop Trail near Clinton Lake in Lawrence. March 2nd, 9 a.m., contact Paul Post at 785-224-3356 or at pacmanpost@icloud.com. On March 2nd, Seed Savers KC has their annual winter seed exchange indoors at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center, 4750 Troost, Kansas City, Missouri. Check Facebook. March 3rd, 2 to 4 p.m., Peaceworks KC invites the public to its annual meeting at Simpson House, 4509 Warwick, Kansas City, Missouri. The meeting features a trio discussing the interface of race, ecology, war, and peace. These items and more can be viewed on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page and at the kkfi.org Eco Radio KC program page.